and welcome to another edition of Sunday Dive. I'm Katie Patrizio, and today we're talking about the readings for the 17th Sunday in Ordinary Time, July 26, 2020. We wrap up the Gospel of Matthew's parables discourse in our readings today. In it, Jesus compares the kingdom of heaven to both a treasure found in a field and a pearl of great price. In evaluating the response to discovery in these stories, we find that Jesus appears to condone a certain level of risk and even deviance when it comes to obtaining the kingdom. In other words, for our Lord, we ought to stop at nothing to obtain the prize of heaven, to which nothing else compares. Thanks for joining us once more. Today we are talking about the readings for the 17th Sunday in Ordinary Time, and we pick up with more parables. And I like the parables a lot. Hopefully you do too, and you're not getting tired of them. However, this Sunday does wrap up our three consecutive Sundays of parables. There's kind of lots of threes we've had the last 3 weeks. So our first set of parables happened 3 weeks ago in our gospel readings. And there we had the parable of the seeds and the soil. And even in that parable itself, we had kind of this threefold aspect to it. So in the parable of the seeds and the soil, there were three kinds of poor soil, right? Where the seed was snatched up, where the seed was scorched, and where the seed was choked. And then there's actually, it's a little more subtle, but there's actually three forms of good soil. The soil that brings forth 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold. Okay, so 3 weeks ago, we got our first parable. There's just one there. But 2 weeks ago, we got our next set of parables, and there were three parables. So last week, we talked about the parable of the weeds and the wheat, looked at darnel, which is a wheat or a weed that looks like wheat, right? The parable, the famous parable of the mustard seed, as well as the parable of the leaven. We touched on how, for one, the amount of bread that is made in this parable is kind of exorbitant, right? Enough to feed well over 100 people. Today in our gospel, we get three more parables. The parable of the treasure in the field, the parable of the pearl of great price, and then the parable of the great net or the great catch or whatever we might want to call it. Some of these parables have like, you know, colloquial names that we've assigned to them culturally because we're familiar with them, but others don't necessarily have very clear titles. So in sum, we get three more wonderful parables in our gospel today, which speak profoundly of the kingdom of heaven. Now, Jesus has spent all this time, just to kind of reiterate, just to kind of do a broad overview of parables again, because we've been spending so much time looking at parables. Jesus has been speaking in parables. We're at Matthew 13, where he speaks almost entirely in parables because previous to this, he began to encounter resistance. And Jesus speaks in parables to protect himself. So he veils his speech a little bit. But as he himself says, you know, he who has ears ought to hear. In other words, if you want to understand what I'm saying, you can. But he doesn't outright come out and say things that may sound obviously controversial to protect himself. I think there's also a sense in which our Lord is protecting himself from soundbiting. Because I don't think soundbiting is something that is only present in our media-soaked society today. But nonetheless, we can understand, we can look at our 24-hour news cycle and see how the media will pick out sound bites of something that someone says, take them out of context, reinterpret them, and then get, you know, hundreds of thousands of people to just hate someone by taking something they said out of context. The parables are a little bit difficult to soundbite, at least to soundbite in a controversial way. You know, if it was the first century, but we still had the 24-hour news cycle or the evening news or whatever, and you were to soundbite Jesus when he's speaking in the parables, there's hardly anything inflammatory in many ways in them, right? So Jesus is a smart guy. He's shrewd. And He's veiling his speech to protect himself and to allow those who have a heart open to his message to still receive the beauty of his message, to still receive his word, right? Not only that, but speaking in parables fulfills Old Testament prophecies. So Matthew himself, I think it was in our gospel last week, quotes from Psalm 78, verse 2, I will open my mouth in parables, saying that Jesus fulfills this psalm and speaking in parables. And we also have a more subtle fulfillment in the fact of 1 Kings 4, 32, where we're told that Solomon spoke in parables, all right? And Jesus presents himself in many ways as a new Solomon. And Solomon's actually going to factor into our readings today. Hopefully we'll have time to get to him. So in order that we will, let's just dive right into our gospel reading. Matthew chapter 13, verses 44 through 52. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which someone found and hid. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and caught fish of every kind. When it was full, they drew it ashore, sat down, and put the good into baskets, but threw out the bad. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all this? They answered, yes. And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. Matthew chapter 13, verses 44 through 52. Let's jump right into it, touching on the parable of the treasure in the field. Some biblical scholars looking at this think that the context of this short but profound parable is likely a farm. So some have even put forth that the man here who finds this treasure may be a peasant working on a larger farm, and he may have come upon this field in, for example, the act of plowing it, okay? First of all, many scholars have also noted that hidden treasure was not unusual in first century Palestine, okay? Especially in a time of kind of unrest. And the centuries leading up to the first century and even, you know, the decades after, or the decades of the first century, I suppose you could say, provided a setting of unrest, right? You had the Roman Empire that was occupying the Jews in Palestine. They were not too kind to the inhabitants of the land. And there were no such thing as, you know, safe deposit boxes or banks or even, you know, offshore bank accounts. And so it was not uncommon for people in that day and age to bury things in order to keep them safe. In fact, we have some semblance of this in relatively recent history. You know, I'm fairly young, right? But I'll hear stories of my grandparents who would put money in a can and bury it, or would put things in the floorboards, would put valuables or money in the floorboards, right? To keep them safe. And this is the same idea here. So what likely happened here is that somebody hid this treasure in the field, but was not able to regain it again before they passed away. And so the treasure was lost. And there are stories, like folk stories, folklore from this time period, first century Near East, that tell stories of finding treasure. So even though this idea of like treasure hunting or something, even though the guy in the parable isn't necessarily treasure hunting, it's not an idea that's only for our modern sensibilities. And just as exciting as it would have been, as it is for us to consider the idea of finding like a great treasure or winning the lottery or something like that, so would have been in first century Judaism, right? In first century Palestine. This guy is just going along. If the narrative that we've created around this parable is correct, this guy is just going along about his business in his day job where he makes barely enough to get by, plowing this field. And as he's plowing this field, he comes upon something, right? He comes upon something. His plow hits something. Who knows? And he digs around a little bit and he uncovers this great treasure. Coins, gold, who knows? Precious rocks. And he, you know, looks over his shoulder, left, right. And he takes care to cover it back up. And then he goes and he sells everything that he has. And then he buys the field, right? This parable is so short and yet so profound, but at the same time, easy for us to gloss over. For one, there's something a little bit almost like devious in this. Which is fascinating that Jesus brings in a little element of potential deviance. Why do I say there might be something deviant here? Well, the man does not know who the treasure belongs to. So it could belong to the current like master of the land. And there's a possibility that offering to buy this piece of land, he is revealing his knowledge. But there's also possibly a sense in which the man who owns the field, and I think this is probably more likely, the man who owns the field, because he sells the field to him, has no idea that the treasure is there. But you could say that really the treasure technically belongs to him, because when it was found, it was in his property, which he owned. And yet, the man goes and he keeps mum, sells everything that he has, which is risky to do, and then buys the field so that he rightly now legally owns the treasure. Why do I say there's something fascinating about Jesus inserting kind of a level of deviance here? Well, for one, if you kind of comb through the Old Testament, for example, I think of Jacob, for example, Jacob and his brother Esau, right? Jacob stole his brother's blessing. He got him to sell his birthright, but in many ways, he stole his blessing. But God, even though Jacob inherited the covenant with Abraham through this, by means of this kind of deviant method, God still gave him the blessing of the covenant, because I believe that, and I think we can pick this out of the Old Testament as we read through it, there's this idea that God is going to respect the man who will do anything he can to get his hands on the treasure that truly matters. God respects the man who does everything he can to get his hands on the treasure that truly matters. And so God, looking at Jacob and Esau, even though Jacob inherited the covenant through a sort of deviant methodology, God looks on him with favor, likely because he sees Jacob as wanting the covenant blessing more than Esau does. And God allows him to have it. So in the case with this, in this parable, and if this parable, which it does, it brings in these realistic ideas of what inheriting the kingdom of heaven is like, it means that God is going to bless those who recognize the beauty of the gift and do whatever it takes to get it, even if it's mildly deviant or risky. Mind you, it's very risky what he does. He sells everything that he has, liquidizes all of his stuff, buys the field with two fingers crossed that no one in the meantime has discovered the treasure in the field. So there's Jesus in his brilliance is able to bring in this element of faith that's also required. He doesn't try to tell us that, he doesn't try to make it out like it isn't kind of difficult or it doesn't take risk or it doesn't take faith. But what he is indeed pointing out is the one who is rewarded, the man who is rewarded is he who's willing to take the risk because he recognizes the treasure. Because the treasure here is the kingdom of heaven, right? Let's continue on. Verse 45, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. So in the first parable, we had a normal everyday guy, maybe even a peasant working under the master of a household or a landowner, right? In the second parable, we have a merchant. Again, easy detail to gloss over, but this is not a peasant. This is a man who is already a little bit well off because if it's a merchant, it means he has a certain level of capital with which he can ply his trade, all right? And he's likely a pearl merchant, right? Because he's in search of fine pearls. So he's already in search of what he wants to find, but he indeed finds this pearl, and it's a pearl unlike any other pearl. But for the parable to make sense, there must be something implied. There must be an idea in which others don't recognize the value of this pearl. So perhaps it's hidden in something, or it has the appearance of a defect, or who knows what, or no one else has just noticed it yet. But nonetheless, the merchant, finding this pearl of great price, does exactly what the peasant in the field does. He goes and sells all that he has and he buys it. Pearls were very valuable in ancient times. Arguably one of the most, if not the most valuable possession one could have. Some scholars have compared pearls in ancient times to diamonds in modern day times. Pearls would be found by diving into water and searching for them. They were often sourced from the Red Sea, from the Persian Gulf, or from the Indian Ocean. And there's records that show that pearls were worth lots of money. Some pearls may have even been worth, if you transfer the currency to our modern day currency, some pearls in ancient times may have even been worth tens of millions of dollars. You'd frequently find them on women's necklaces. Tens of millions of dollars. He sells all that he has to buy this pearl of great price. And being a merchant, in contrast to the peasant, to sell all that he has is to sell a lot. Is to sell a lot. But what is it? What is it? It's to put all of his faith in that one pearl of great price. To recognize that the risk is worth it. that to sell, to get rid of everything he has is worth it in order to obtain this one pearl. This one pearl is worth more than everything he owns. Without giving a thought to the cost, right? That's interesting because scholars have also pointed out that the image of a pearl has been used by other ancient rabbis in parable-like teachings to kind of image the study of Torah. So if our man here in our parable, our merchant here in our parable, sells all that he has in order to buy the pearl, because for us in our parable, the pearl is the image of the kingdom of heaven. In other rabbinic teaching, the pearl would have meant, had the meaning of Torah and studying Torah. And so it's fascinating that here Jesus uses a similar kind of image, but he's not pointing his audience towards Torah. Rather, he's pointing his audience towards the kingdom. And we actually already saw this in an earlier section of Matthew, an earlier gospel reading in Matthew, where Jesus talks about his yoke. And we discussed how yoke was a common term in first century Judaism and always referred to Torah. And so it's shocking when Jesus doesn't teach his disciples to take the yoke of Torah upon them, but rather to take his own yoke upon them. In the same way, for Jesus to compare the pearl not to the Torah, but rather to compare the pearl to the kingdom, we have this idea of Jesus ushering in this kind of new reality. He's ushering in a new reality that what matters is not the Torah, but what matters is the kingdom. What matters is the kingdom. Let's keep reading. Verse 47. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and caught fish of every kind. When it was full, they drew it ashore, sat down, and put the good into baskets, but threw out the bad. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Okay. So this was a profound parable for Jesus to speak because he's still preaching on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, where the primary commerce was fishing, and his audience was likely full of fishermen or family members of fishermen. And the setting may have even lent, if he was in view of the Sea of Galilee, to the actual scene of fishing as he's proclaiming this parable, right? He uses a word for a particular kind of net here. There were several different kinds of nets in fishing in the first century, used for fishing in the first century, and several different methods, okay? So, for example, when we read about Jesus encountering Peter and Andrew on the Sea of Galilee and they're casting their nets, most scholars are in agreement that they must have been fishing with a net known as a cast net, all right? And this is a net that you would actually stand on the shore and throw it into the water. It was round and it had weights along the bottom so that it would sink to the bottom of the ocean, or not to the bottom of the ocean, but the bottom of the water. And then they would dive into the water and gently gather the net that had hopefully found itself over some fish and be able to bring them to the shore, right? But that's not what Jesus is talking about here. He's not talking about a cast net. What he's talking about here is something called in English a drag net. And this is probably actually the form of fishing that we would conjure in our minds when we think of Peter and Andrew and any of the other disciples fishing on the Sea of Galilee. This was a very large net, a long net that had buoys on the top, so flotation devices on the top, and then weights on the bottom to make sure that the net stayed stretched about when it was in the water. And you would typically need two crews to really be able to operate a drag net. So one on one side and one on the other. You could do it closer to the shore just by swimming and wading in the water. But it's likely, at least in our parable here, since they draw in a great catch, that since they bring in fish of every kind, that they were, these teams were likely out in the water in boats, okay? And so they would just spread the net, and then they would sail towards the shore. And it would just, the net would just fill up with all different kinds of fish, as you can imagine, indiscriminately, right? Whereas with a cast net, these fishermen who had knowledge of different species of fish and where they like to be, might be able to manipulate his catch a little bit more, might be able to be a little bit more discriminating. A drag net is not going to do that. It's going to bring in every kind of fish indiscriminately. But what would happen with these fishermen, they would drag the net to shore, right? They'd sail to shore with it out. And then when they get closer to the shore, they'd come out of the water, they drag the net into the shore, and they would sort the fish. Good fish from bad fish. But there's an aspect of this that was deeply important. They weren't just sorting the fish from, oh, Peter likes this kind of fish, Andrew likes this kind of fish. You have to remember, and this is easy to forget, the Jews had kosher laws. And of the some 24 different species of fish in the Sea of Galilee, several of them were unclean, which meant they were essentially inedible. They were not fit to be eaten by Jews, right? Because they were not kosher. And so the fishermen would sit on the shore and they would literally sort the good fish from the bad fish. The clean fish from the unclean fish. The kosher fish from the unkosher fish, right? Those that were good, they would keep. And those that were bad, they would throw out. And so it says, so Jesus says, it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the furnace fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I think it's fascinating that Jesus ends this threefold section of parables with this kind of separation parable, right? Because in the first two parables, he makes it very clear to us that the kingdom of heaven is a prize, which cannot be compared to anything else we can possess on earth. Why? Because both the man in the field and the merchant who finds the pearl, they sell all that they have without a second thought in order to possess that great prize, which is the kingdom of heaven. But some people, when they encounter that great prize, do not make the choice, the necessary choice, to pursue the prize, but that does not prevent them from being sorted out at the end of the age. Those who choose not to pursue the prize, it's not as if they are exempt from the choice. So refusing to choose, in other words, is not an option, because at the end of the day, the kingdom of God is like a net thrown into the sea that will catch everyone in many ways. But it will be sorted out, the good from the bad. What Jesus is doing for us here is showing us the kingdom in stark reality. He's showing us the kingdom in stark reality. He's showing us our priorities in stark reality. I just got what I feel like is probably the best week of circumstances in order to meditate on these readings. So I live in Iowa. I'm originally from California, so I don't have any family out here in the Midwest. But for that reason, I've kind of been adopted by my best friend's family out here in Iowa. And the matriarch of their family, the grandma, right, who I've gotten pretty close to as well, was home on hospice all this week and actually just passed away this past Sunday. And I had the experience, the first time experience, which I'm sure many of you listening have had before, the profound experience of being able to spend day after day after day with someone who's on their deathbed. And there's nothing like spending day after day after day with someone who is dying to remind you of what is important. And the beautiful thing about Mary, about this person, about this this kind of adopted grandma, is that she had a wonderful faith life. And so for everyone else around her, her friends and her family, there was not a lot of concern about her soul. Or maybe I should say there was a lot of peace about it, especially because, you know, a priest was able to come out and give her last rites and the apostolic pardon, which is an awesome indulgence that you should look into if any of your family or friends are ever near death. And everyone could just be with her and contemplate what was coming, which is a meditation that's relevant to all of us because it's what's coming for all of us. Just some of us are farther away from it than others, right? And the meditation is so profound when you're with someone who's just a few days or a few hours away from that. And it's so profound in relation to our readings today, to our gospel, because what is important when you are hours from death? Nothing. Nothing. None of the normal things that we feel are important are important. When we think about our lives, we often think about, I want it to go this way, I want it to go that way, I want to have this much, you know, retirement when I'm this age, I want to have, you know, children, I want to have grandchildren, I want to have this kind of job, I want to be retired at this point. We have like everything perfectly planned out. And yet what Jesus is saying is that everything of value to us is nothing compared to the kingdom of heaven. It is nothing. And if Jesus's parables are not profound enough for us to get this point, we have the beautiful example of the apostles who, like the peasant in the field and the merchant searching for the pearl, left everything to follow Jesus. They left everything. All that matters is this great prize that God has prepared for us. And yet so many of us choose to squander our resources and our energy on things that at the end of the day just do not matter. And if we exempt ourselves from the choice, God still cannot exempt us from the reality that at the end of the day, the fish will be sorted. And those that are good will be put into baskets and kept, but those that are bad will be thrown away. Verse 51, have you understood all this? Jesus asks the answer. Yes, he says to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. This is so perplexing. Actually, some people have proposed that this is a parable in its own right, in which case we have four parables here. But this is kind of odd. This is a little bit mysterious, but it's really interesting because if we go, for example, to Sirach, chapter 38 and 39, particularly 39, but the theme of the reading is introduced in chapter 38. Sirach 39 is telling us what a good scribe does. Sirach 39, verse 1. On the other hand, he who devotes himself to the study of the law of the Most High, which is a scribe, will seek out the wisdom of all the ancients and will be concerned with prophecies. He will preserve the discourse of notable men and penetrate the subtleties of parables. He will seek out the hidden meaning of proverbs and will be at home with the obscurities of parables. That's so interesting. So what Jesus is saying is that every scribe trained for the kingdom of heaven is indeed like the scribe in Sirach 39, who can penetrate the subtleties of parables and is at home with their obscurities, who seeks out the hidden meanings of proverbs. And in the context of a scribe in the kingdom of heaven is fascinating in and of itself because Jesus' followers were in general not learned people. Matthew, who wrote our gospel, definitely could be described as a scribe. But Peter and Andrew, the other apostles who were fishermen and had manual trades, they were definitely not scribes. So what is a scribe? Well, generally speaking, a scribe is a literate person, and there were not many of those in the first century necessarily. They're a literate person who generally took care of bureaucracy. So they're going to be your tax mans like Matthew, your tax men. They're going to be your administrators. They're going to be your secretaries, all right? They're helping run the kingdom. But there's also a sense, especially in first century Judaism, in which the scribe was the man learned in Torah. Why is that? Well, because, you know, with the fall of, you know, both the Davidic monarchy and then even the Hasmonean dynasty, Jews were not involved in bureaucracy anymore. Why? Because the Romans were ruling and you know, you had a few people like Matthew, a few Jews who were participating in the Roman occupation. But in general, Jews no longer were participating in the bureaucracy. So generally, to be a scribe in first century Judaism meant you were learned in the law. You were kind of like the academic of the day, the Jewish academic. And you knew the law well, and you even taught the law. You had students, and they called you rabbi, right? These are not the kind of men that Jesus calls around him, but nevertheless, the scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. And this is not clear, right, necessarily what Jesus is saying, but I think that there's a sense in many biblical scholars and commentaries on scripture have put forth this idea that what the disciples who hear and understand the parables, who therefore in Jesus's mind are the scribes of the kingdom of heaven, what they will be able to do is to take Jesus's new teaching as well as the old teaching of the Old Testament and bring them together. And this is a profound idea for me because I love the connection between the old and the new. There are a few things that excite me more than the ways that Jesus fulfills the old in the new that he brings about. And there's this sense in which the scribes of the kingdom of heaven are able to read the new into the old and read the old into the new. They are the master of the household who brings out of their treasure what is new and what is old. They are indeed the scribe of the book of Sirach, who penetrates the subtleties of parables, who seeks out the hidden meaning of proverbs, and who is at home with the obscurities of parables. Why? Because by God's grace and wisdom, they are able to understand things because they have ears that hear. Unlike the other scribes, the quote-unquote real scribes of Judaism, who've hardened their hearts and closed their ears and cannot hear. Therefore, they cannot penetrate the subtleties and obscurities of the parables. They're uncomfortable with them, and they certainly can't see the ways in which Jesus in the new fulfills the old, right? Now, I can't end. I promised that I would tie in Solomon here, and in brilliant fashion, as the church often does, right? As the scribe of the kingdom of heaven, the church is able to connect the Old Testament so often with the New Testament. And so in our first reading today, the church gives us 1 Kings 3, 5, and 7 through 12. And I'm actually going to read verse 6 as well, because it gives a kind of continuity and context. This is from the New Revised Standard Version, 1 Kings 3, 5. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I should give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant, my father David, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And you have kept for him this great and steadfast love and have given him a son to sit on his throne today. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. Although I am only a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of the people whom you have chosen, a great people so numerous they cannot be numbered or counted. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, able to discern between good and evil, for who can govern this, your great people?" It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. God said to him, "Because you have asked this and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, I now do according to your word. Indeed, I give you a wise and discerning mind. No one like you has been before you, and no one like you shall arise after you." So God does for Solomon what all of us wish he would do for us. He comes to Solomon and he says, "I will give you whatever you want. Ask of me." And what does Solomon ask for? Not for long life, as God says, or for riches, or for the life of his enemies, for victory over his enemies. Rather, Solomon asks for wisdom. And God pleased with Solomon's desire, his desire to know Torah, to know right from wrong, to know the Lord, right? Is perfect. And so God is pleased to grant him his desire. And friends, God is pleased to grant us this desire as well if we conjure it up in our hearts, this desire to understand the heart of God, this desire to understand the prize of the kingdom of heaven. But it is not enough merely to understand, because we must act. And the kingdom of God is as a treasure found in a field, which a man desires to have. And so he sells all his belongings and buys that field. The kingdom is like a merchant in search of fine pearls who finds one of great value, and he sells all that he has in order to buy that pearl. Lord, help us to understand what your kingdom is. Help us to understand that nothing compares to the treasure of heaven. And help us to understand that happiness is you. And that in selling all, in giving up everything else, Lord, we gain everything. Everything in return. Because nothing is greater than you. Nothing is greater than heaven. Lord, help us always to make you our priority.